Okay.
Thank you very much. We shall move on to rate regulation, which is paper 5. With this session, as I know you're all aware, we issued, or the ISB issued, a discussion paper in September 2014, which has a comment deadline of 15 January 2015. And we thought this would be a good opportunity for sharing any preliminary views that any of the ASAF members have developed so far, and also to give you an opportunity to ask questions or raise any comments, seek clarification on the contents of the discussion paper, if that would help as you are developing, or as I hope you're developing, your responses to that discussion paper. Within the discussion paper, there is talk of some high-level accounting approaches that the ISB could possibly take. The ISB hasn't expressed any preference on these approaches because really we are still at the early stages of this project, and the discussion paper is focusing primarily on, have we got a good description of rate regulation and how it affects the financial position and performance of an entity? Going back to Francoise and Rebecca's point on emission trading schemes, we're looking at trying to identify what information is most relevant to the users of the financial statements, and trying to really get a good grasp of those two factors, the effects of the rate regulation, the user needs, before expending effort on developing a detailed accounting model. So that there is just some high-level outlines of possible approaches that we could take to see if there are any that are, you know, non-starters, if you like, or do some of them have potential to develop. So again, at this forum, if you've got any questions, would like any clarifications, we'd like to hear those. In the description of the accounting treatments, one of them talks about the possibility of deferring or accelerating the recognition of costs, or the recognition of revenue, or a combination of cost and revenue. We haven't used US GAAP as a specific example of that, but some of the description touches on examples that are similar to US GAAP. So in a moment I'm going to ask Tom, who has very kindly offered to give us a very quick run through some of the US GAAP guidance on deferral and acceleration of cost and revenue. After that, I'll then call on Francoise. EFRAG have done a lot of work so far and have already developed some preliminary views that are included in a draft comment letter that is currently going through their due process and seeking comments from constituents in Europe. And then I'll open the floor for any other preliminary views or comments that people have. So with that, Tom, I'll hand over to you.
Thanks, Jane. You've all had my presentation, and so I'm not going to run through the slides in detail, right? But and it's been a challenge for me because I was obviously not part of the board that deliberated this long ago. There's no one even at the FASB, even Leising Ring, that was around when this was deliberated. So what I've tried to do is go through a journey to try to understand perhaps the basis for how we got to regulatory assets and liabilities in U.S. GAAP. Some may assert, when they begin to think about that, that it's just an exception. It's an override to the basic model, and it's industry-specific guidance that overrides thinking. I do not believe that's the basis for regulatory assets and liabilities within U.S. GAAP. I think the basis is so every rate regulated or regulated enterprise in the United States GAAP does not end up with regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. They only do so to the extent that the rate making compact gives unique rights or obligations to that particular enterprise within the economy. And so certain rate-regulated enterprises would not have regulatory assets or liabilities. It would be dependent on the nature of the rate-making contract. And I want to make that very clear. So we don't view in the United States US GAAP that this being an exception. I think what it is to say that there are certain unique rights and obligations in the rate making contract that if you want to really reflect in the financial reports the true rights and obligations and the economics out of rate making, you would result in certain assets or liabilities being recognized different from other enterprises because they do not, the other enterprises do not have those rights or obligations. And so when we look at the discussion paper of the ISB, there's several approaches at the back end. And some might say that, and Jay just depicted the US GAAP as being approach of deferring cost or deferring revenue, all right? That might be a way of characterizing it, but that might seem to be an exception. So what I did is when I developed this particular presentation is to go back to say, does applying the conceptual framework definition of assets and liabilities result in these regulatory assets and liabilities, not just arbitrary deferrals of cost or of cost or revenue? And so the presentation tries to justify this is an application of the conceptual framework and does result in unique assets and liabilities because of the rate-making contract that have been enforced regularly within our courts and system. Okay. But the important point on slide 3 is there are differences in regulatory regimes that might suggest that there would be no regulatory asset or liability that could potentially result in a rate-making compact. And the particular area I think where there might be some stress is in the effect of incentive programs, which may not really end up resulting in what a cost of service regulation suggests is that if I incur a cost this period that was not anticipated in a rate making compact or decision with an entity, with a rate maker, I've incurred those costs, but the rate making compact has said those such costs will be able to be recovered in future rate making. The incurrence of those costs create an asset, the right to revenue in the future related to those costs, and call it an asset until the revenues occur in the future, and then you'd expense that asset in the period. Or if what you end up doing is getting cash early that wasn't anticipated within the rate making contract, but the rate making compact or the decision says if you get more cash than is expected in that agreement, we're going to lower the amount of revenue you get in the future. That's not unlike getting cash up front before you performed on a revenue basis. I've got cash before I performed. And when I perform in the future, that cash, I'll have a liability performance obligation that will be recognized in the future period. And that, because it's out of a regulatory agreement, that liability, the performance obligation, becomes a regulatory liability. Okay. And that's the basis under US GAAP that I try to walk through in the presentation. And some may say, who's the counterparty? There's not specific counterparties that I can get this from. The rate making compact says the counterparty is the class of customers, however constituted, whenever it's happening. It's not any specific person you get money back from or you recover or you help in this process. It's the class of customers. And I think, as you'll see in my presentation, if you were to look at slide, when I get to US GAAP, the requirements that you get into on slide 12, what the key scope criteria for being able to get regulatory assets or liabilities, I think the scope criteria within US GAAP is far weaker than what the ISB is proposing in their discussion paper in thinking about the revenue requirements. So what might be, what is the nature of the regulatory compact that would lead to regulatory assets and liabilities? Now, when I read US GAAP, the criteria that are on page 12 there, I think are tied to but not specified as well as what is in the revenue requirements or defined rate regulation within the ISB's discussion paper, but it's the same sort of notion moving forward. I don't think I have anything else that I really want to get into here specifically, But there are notions in U.S. GAAP that certain sorts of costs wouldn't result in regulatory assets or liabilities. Right within U.S. GAAP, there's the notion if I build a new plant and it's not pre-committed to be able to recover the whole cost of the plant, but there might be a phase-in of that plant, unless the rate maker has decided that you are going to get recovery phased in for the cost of the plant, unless that's the case, you don't get a regulatory asset for those costs, okay, at all. And I would think, although the U.S. system hasn't been stressed much by incentive programs, because there are not very many incentive programs in the United States. There is a real old EITF that gets a little bit into incentive programs, but it has not been stressed much. But I think there's a very open question in terms of incentive programs as to whether there is any right or obligation that results in the rate-making compact there that would suggest differential reporting. I think that's a challenge. And in the very last slide, I go through and mention that there are challenges and pitfalls within the application of U.S. GAAP, because some interpret U.S. GAAP as saying, I'm a rate-regulated enterprise, regardless I get to get these regulatory assets or liabilities. And that's not the basis that are within U.S. GAAP. And as indicated there is also not about a lot of guidance or a lot of need for considering incentive programs. I'd be happy to answer any questions if people or any challenges to the analysis.
Tom, one thing that I wondered about was the elasticity of demand. There's an underlying assumption that you can put up your prices and people will still use the same amount of electricity. And it's interesting in Australia, the prices have gone up a lot in the last 5 years. And actually people are using less electricity. The demand, overall demand, is dropping. And so you would start to test that assumption that between the regulator and the supplier, they can just set rates and collect them, you know, absolutely. And I think that's going to be a case around the world a bit, because the costs are getting very high. Electricity costs are getting very high. People are looking at alternatives or just turning things off.
I don't know inherent within U.S. GAAP whether it's an elasticity of demand or recognition that it's an absolute necessary good for many people and there will be demand. And because it's the infrastructure costs of being able to supply that within a region are so high that it is cost beneficial to set up a system that sort of reduces competition, so that you don't incur all those fixed costs. And the existence of demand will be there. People need electricity. They need water. They need certain things. And I don't know that it's inelasticity as much as there will be demand, and what we need to be doing is covering, making sure that by having a structure that's a monopoly, the monopolist does not get to charge excess rents.
Well, but I think you missed the point a bit, because I understand all that, but there has come a point in Australia within a regulated system where the price is such that people are resisting. So you can't just say there is a demand that will have to be met, because the demand is reducing because the price is too high. That's what I mean by and it must surely be the same in the United States at some point. Maybe you've never got to that point. But that, you can say within rate regulated, that's a measurement question. So you might be able to bring that back to measurement rather than a definition of asset or liability question. I don't know. But the underlying assumption does worry me a bit.
Well, I think some of what's recovered in rates that's not talked about a lot in the papers is a volume problem. And some of the reasons you get recovery is you've got fixed costs and you've got variable costs. And if you take the fixed plus variable, assuming a certain demand, and if the demand stays the same, you're going to get the total revenue requirement and the return's not going to be excess above so. But if you end up having change in demand underneath, you could end up, because of the fixed cost sort of things being covered within the certain range of expected demand, either collecting too much or not collecting enough. And that volume difference is contemplated in cost of service regulation.
Sure.
Yeah, that you end up, if you end up selling more than you expected, there was an inherent refund to customers and or a lowering of future rates. So I don't think within the cost of service rate making setting, is another way of trying to respond to you, there's a belief about fixed demand because of the recovery when there's big volume differences. Now, within a range, they're not going to worry about it. But if there's a lot of demand or a lot less demand, they work it through in the system. So there is still the ability to end up having customers make some decisions as to whether they really want to go this way. But there's some difficulty, I think, established for certain of these goods that they can't say they don't want any of it. They may want less of it.
The way to recovery in the United States, the way the firm recover this amount is through rate fixation. It's not a cash mechanism.
Most of the time, yes.
Yeah.
Because if I get a cash mechanism, then I don't have your problem. So if he received a specific amount of cash from the government.
Yeah, I think Alessandro there brings in two points. One is that if the price gets so high that customers can't afford to pay it.
Or don't want to pay it.
Can we take it in two steps. One is that people can't afford to pay it, but these are considered essential goods.
It will not be zero, but it can be reduced by it.
Exactly. There are examples where the government steps in and provides a subsidy, so it pays the company some amount. And that's a separate accounting issue that I don't think should knock you out of the scope completely of the description of defined rate regulation. The other thing is it's often a timing thing. So as Tom said, the regulator anticipates the volume of demand, and that's when the rate is set. If that volume doesn't come through, if the mechanism is such that it then rolls forward any unrecovered amount, it just delays the timing of recovery rather than stopping
it. The government can compensate you through a different mechanism.
In some cases, they do.
Yeah, and not just the price, I give you a tax incentive, for example.
Exactly. And in the discussion paper, we've acknowledged that there are these other mechanisms for compensation for the company. But to try and focus the discussion, we're making an assumption that the customers will ultimately pay the rates that are necessary. But it's not just over 1 year. It could take several years for the variances to cycle through.
Even that assumption over a few years is a little bit brave, I think.
Well, you're arguing whether it's an essential good or not.
I don't think that in Australia they will be switching off their air conditioning.
They are.
A little bit, but
they
but
not totally true. Yeah. But it means the agreement between the regulator and the supplier may not work.
They actually changed the regulation in Brazil at the moment, so because of this rule. So what they end up having is they compensate you through rate mechanism. But if the rate mechanism is not enough, I give you a direct cash inflow.
Yeah.
So it's a complementary to you.
Sure.
I think you're raising the point whether there's volume adjustments or not inherent within the rate making compact.
I'm raising the point whether there is actually an asset or not, or it might be a measurement question. Because it's not possible, even though the regulator tells you you can charge all that much extra, you're not going to make extra money out of it.
That was the discussion, because if you do not have demand, you do not have an asset.
It is a scoping problem about essential goods.
Chris?
Well, I think mine was a related question. What do you think the asset that you have really is? Is it a right to charge a particular price to recover, or is it actually a right to the cash that's already been incurred? And in other words, I'm not quite sure. Do you treat these as financial assets, or do you treat them as some sort of intangible assets, or are they some sort of...
I don't know the answer for sure, but I think they're called regulatory assets. They're unique.
They're unique. Is
eventually there will be cash.
No, because
that's not an exception, because it's unique that you've got the rate making compact.
But the question is, where would you draw the line? Because there's lots of cases we've got an expectation that you're going to actually earn income in the future, and we don't bring those on as assets today.
But there's no agreement that's enforceable through acts in the courts in this alternative situation?
I'm not so sure.
It is a right on revenue based on past non-performance.
Yeah, but the right is to charge more. And my point is that may or may not lead to more revenue. Depends on the market.
But I mean, in order for us to be able to recognize it must be a right to revenue and not just a right to charge.
Charge more for projector per unit of goods expected to be delivered. And so even if you get a downward adjustment, what they're going to do is allocate that over a lesser amount of goods.
But there's a point where that breaks down.
If you have a pure cash model,
that is not guaranteed. The system we cannot call it an asset.
Very key to this discussion is there's acts that have put this in place that have been supported by the courts that have not caused someone to have to be able to lose the inability to recover.
Okay, but what happens if there is a complete drop in demand? What's going to happen in that case? How is any government actually going to enforce customers to pay it other than actually step in and make a grant? Now, if that was the case and there's an actual guarantee, I wouldn't have any problems at all because I think you've got a financial asset. You've actually got a right to cash.
Well, the scoping here, I believe, is that it is an essential good. So, all right? It's an essential good.
So the assumption is that elasticity of demand doesn't exist.
It's not as responsive as in any other competitive situation. I don't want to say it's completely inelastic, but I think that's the assumption that's there, and I think it's been...
That's right, and that was the assumption I was trying to...
And I think it's proved out, but that's, I think, a scoping decision. And as I said, every regulated situation, the view here isn't that every regulated situation should end up getting these circumstances.
Roger?
I had two questions. I think you've partly answered the first. I totally understand how this works in the cost model when you're deferring or accelerating costs. But supposing you have a warm winter and therefore you've sold less gas or electricity, so your profits are down. So your model would also encompass accruing revenue for the profits you expect to earn in future years to even that situation out, would it? Listen, you're no longer in a cost model now. You're just effectively saying, well, we haven't had much volume this year.
If there are volume adjustments within the rate-making compact.
So that would work. And secondly, certainly in Europe, we have a lot of schemes where after 5 years, the whole thing starts again. So the regulator will have a five-year round, and then it will all reset to zero. Do you have that in the US? And how would you deal with creating those regulatory assets if you were uncertain whether you weren't certain you would ever actually earn them out before the end of the 5 years?
Some of the commitments under these rate-making compacts are not within the 3 to 5 year windows, typical 3 to 5 year windows, but are committing to when they rate-make again that they're going to adjust in the future. But if they are not going to end up adjusting it within the 3 to 5 year window, or if it's beyond the 3 to 5 year window in the next rate-making agreement, I don't think you have a right or obligation.
Okay. Yeah.
Mary?
Comment with a bit of speculation on my part, and then two questions for Tom about thinking in the original FAST 71 model. The comment and a bit of speculation is, Tom, you said that there's been very little consideration of incentive plans because they just are not that
prevalent
in the U.S. And that there's some tension between that and the range of responses we got to the original request for information that Jane ran prior to the discussion paper that I think included commentary about seeing some of the plus or minus ranges growing before an adjustment kicked in, and wasn't that starting down the road to an incentive program? But my speculation is that while many people were talking about this in the context of applying FAS 71, it might have been context in which FAS 71 but not US GAAP was being applied, so where FAS 71 had been lifted up and dropped in, because we certainly got the sense that a FAS 71 type model was being applied in situations in which there was quite a substantial incentive element, which seemed, as you highlight on the last slide, to stress the scoping of FAS 71. So I think that it may be an issue when you talk about U.S. GAAP, you're talking about U.S. GAAP in a U.S. rate-making environment, and many of the discussions about U.S. GAAP are in a non, at least FAS 71, are in a non-U.S. rate-making environment, and people carried over the mechanisms without necessarily carrying over the scope entirely. You know, so
That's sort of the challenges in the back and the top of the things. People are extrapolating being in a rate-making environment that they automatically get this.
Right. And so that was the comment piece.
Better give Francois some time. So
Two questions for Tom about the model and the thinking that went into it. One is your focus on the compact to me suggests, you know, the first thing that comes to mind if I try and listen to a cold is that there's an intangible, you know, that the compact gives rise to an intangible, not unlike a license. And I was interested if in your research about, you know, the history of the decisions, whether there'd been any consideration about that. And that may just be life evolving from the, 40 years ago that FAS 71 was done, because your emphasis on the compact, to me, raises the question of intangible. The second point is, Roger focused on cost deferral, and I think one of the things that comes out and we want to make people focus on in the discussion paper is if you think you have a regulatory right, is it necessarily cost or is it revenue? Because I think you're using cost as a proxy for the measurement of the future revenue recovery, and should it really be a deferral of cost, or is that just kind of the shorthand that has evolved? And again, question about whether there's any evidence about why FASB went down the cost deferral approach as opposed to saying X, you know, the cost I've incurred in this period is the amount of revenue I expect in the future, and therefore what I'm doing is, you know, should be doing is accruing the future revenue.
I would say that I didn't see anywhere in my research in the past any reference to intangibles or thinking about an intangible, though I think the agreement of an essential good and protecting that organization setting up the ability to do it by yourself for the betterment of society, that there is no competition, sort of feels like there's a franchise there that you're protecting through the revenue. But I wouldn't say it's an intangible notion tied to your second question. Some people characterize the FASB model as a cost deferral model. I would not. It's a cost deferral or a revenue and or a revenue deferral model. Because if you end up collecting cash, so one of the things in most rate making compacts, there's this say, generally I am going to get money from my customers. But if I end up selling some of my assets at either a gain or a loss that wasn't anticipated in the rate making compact, and therefore I get a net loss or a net gain in cash as a result of that sale, that's going to adjust future rates because it wasn't anticipated from the customer. Okay? And so if I get a gain by selling things at more than their cost, there's a commitment in the existing rate making compact that you will reduce future rates as a result of that gain. That's a revenue deferral. It's both.
It wasn't that aspect that I was worried about, but we can go on. I was just interested in the history.
We have to move on.
I think Francois is going to give us an overview.
Yeah. Can we move on from Francois? Otherwise, we're going to overrun in time.
So I was asked, in fact, to give you some insights into both the results of the outreach to users that we conducted and also, in fact, the preliminary views that have been reached on the discussion paper, and I'm going to try to do that as quickly as feasible. So we, in fact, started our outreach to users early in order to have some input into the analysis of the discussion paper, but it remains an ongoing effort And in fact, we are going also to have an outreach event in December. So we continue to learn. Basically, what we have heard from users, and when we the elements that I'm giving here, I'm concentrated of those users that are involved in analyzing, you know, entities in the rate-regulated industry. We have had contacts with others, but what I'm reporting here is more directly at those who are analyzing the sectors. So basically, they're unanimous to say that IFRS financial statements today does not provide the information that they need. And they find their information in otherwise, just because it's provided by the entity voluntarily, in investor presentation, in regulatory accounts, I mean, in other ways. Most of them indicate that the effects of rate regulation should be give rise to recognition of the impacts in the financial statements, saying that it's much superior to disclosures, but they're not unanimous. What do they say they need? First of all, of course, to understand the rate regulation mechanism, how it works, the why this mechanism can be subject to changes, how it affects the entity, the level of enforceability that the rate mechanism provides, and also the level of commitment of the regulator in supporting, in fact, the revenue requirements. So all this is, you know, in harm the reliability, basically, of the mechanism to generate the promised returns to the entity. And of course, they're interested in the revenue requirement itself and the level of returns that it will allow to the entity. In terms of financial data, they need insight into how the entity will recover its cost and generate sufficient returns. So that develops into a need to understand the differences, in fact, between billable revenue and the revenue requirement, and basically how this will affect the profile of future cash flows going forward. They want to understand the causes of variability of revenue and related costs, for example, I mean, exactly what Jan said about a possible drop in demand. The recoverability of cost, the activities that the entity will perform, basically all elements that affect the evolution of the revenue requirement or that suggest capital expenditures going forward. And also, and in a way, but also very importantly, a proper disaggregation per jurisdiction, anyway, at a level where the revenue requirement can be understood. So that's the overview of what we've learned from users so far. If I move to the preliminary views that we have exposed in our draft comment letter, basically, I think the draft letter is broadly positive. First of all, welcoming the discussion paper and the efforts that are starting, basically because, I mean, what we hear from the users in outcry for information. One of the main questions, of course, is to define the scope appropriately, and we had also in this group identified that it was an important question. On that, we have identified the defined rate regulation as proposed in the DP as a good place to start. We do not exclude that possible reporting requirements will have also wider scope, so that some would be subject to recognition requirements, others would have only disclosures to provide. When we have looked at the defined rate regulation and the way it was proposed, we have also agreed with this description as being a very good starting point. But in the list of characteristics that we're given, we have highlighted the enforceable rights and obligations that may arise from the rate regulation mechanisms as, in fact, the main factor. All the others being more indicators of the level of those rights and obligations and the level of enforceability of the rights and obligation. What in our view gives economic substance and in fact enforceability to those rights and obligations will heavily depend on the legal framework, how the regulation in fact binds the customer and in fact the customer base, and also circumstances of very low demand risk would be the way we would characterize things instead of looking at whether there is competition or not. And that also links to the discussion that we've just had. In terms of accounting, the first point is that we would insist that, I mean, probably many basis, but this one I think is don't expect it to be changed, that the approach should be principle-based in a way like Jane summarized on the emission trading schemes. The concern is the same. You need to have a principle-based approach so not to unduly exclude, in fact, regulation mechanisms that are different but basically generate similar economic effects. And we have identified the revenue approach as being the one that seems to have a central role to play, basically because it is in the delivery of the goods and services to customers that the defined rate regulation entitles the entity to earn its returns. So that's really the central role. We have not completely ruled out that a cost element might have a role to play. It may help accommodate differences in schemes. We don't know, so we have not ruled it out at this stage. We have not given much credit to the other possibilities that are developed in the discussion paper, and basically referring to the arguments that were exposed in the discussion paper in doing that. In terms of presentation, would what is still called default balances be recognized? We would think that they have to be separately presented because they will be particular. Also that disclosures are needed, that the disclosures in IFRS 14 seems to be a very good basis. Also that sufficient disaggregation is given so to meet the need of users to understand the revenue requirement in the way it plays, and more particularly if in segment reporting or otherwise, if you have rate regulated activities which are part of a larger group. So that's about it.
Thank you, Françoise. Any comments?
Yeah, I think, you know, the ASBJ appreciate the quality of the IASB's discussion paper of the rate regulated activities. And I think, you know, discussion paper is a good starting point to move forward the discussion of this important but difficult issue. In our preliminary analysis, we find that it's very difficult to argue against the assertion that right and the obligation that are created in the context of defined right regulation is likely to meet the definition of an asset and liability, as well as the recognition criteria against IASB's latest tentative decision in the conceptual framework. However, we are not sure if this analysis would immediately result in the conclusion that the regulatory deferral asset and liabilities should be recognized on the statement of financial position, because we wonder if it is just because these definitions and the recognition criteria are too encompassing or are not tight enough to make an appropriate assessment. So if we, this is the case, we need to seriously think about what would be the appropriate definitions of an asset and liability as well as recognition criteria before the conceptual framework project is finalized.
Jung-woo.
Thank you. Generally, I'm happy to see the temporary comment on the proposal. But on paragraph 13, here, this is a very minor point, but actually, I'm just curious. You just put the rate regulator, type of a regulator, putting explicitly, you are stating external rate regulator. In the case of US GAAP, this was one issue. In the case of cooperative utilities, they might do their own board of maybe some kind of maybe governors, or they can decide this one. But do you have any some kind of intention to put this phrase in the definition of this defined rate regulation?
I think the, what led us to this is the need for enforceability and also reliability in fact the way the mechanism operates.
Yan Xiao.
First of all, I agree with most of the points raised by the Francois. The paper is very good. Especially, I'm very interested that the paper suggested that the point from user side, whether what kind of information users they needed and what kind of solution they want. So with this side, I would like to ask a question to Tom, whether there are any empirical research has been done or has or in place that in US when some regulatory assets or liability has been recognized or has been presented on financial position statement. And those research has found that it's useful, meaningful to users. Or whether there are any finding has been found that from financial analysts, whether there are any debate on that, or whether they have made some adjustment on those assets or liabilities, because maybe there are some question, because for those assets, actually there are no economic resource, physically economic resource in place at current stage. It's really rely on future events or transactions. So I want to know whether there are any finding or any in place. So this is the first question. The second question, actually, we also undertake some survey or investigation in China to ask whether do you like this solution which proposed that some of regulatory assets and liabilities should be presented on financial statements from user side. It seems that many user side are worried about the result of the maybe there are some opportunity for company to manage their earnings because it's accounting result to try to remove smooth the earnings, so they are worried about whether there are any chance for company to do earnings management. So especially for if you look at China, some of companies actually they are state-owned enterprises. There are some close relationship with government there. So it's if those assets, you know, just depends on future recovery benefits, they can be recognized assets on the balance sheet, and then there are some benefits where revenue recognized in income statement. So they are worried about earnings management. So from other side, I have worked on some empirical research on earnings management. So I'm not sure whether there are any empirical research in this area in earnings management in US, find something companies are trying to manage manage earnings by this way, and then users are very cautious or very worried about that.
If US GAAP is applied correctly, regulatory assets and liabilities result in only very, very narrow circumstances. That is, where there is an agreement in place that the rate regulator has made that has been that's been proven to be enforceable in courts over time, that when they made an agreement that you will be able to recover costs in future rates, and it's occurred, and it's a legal agreement. So it isn't management making the choice as to whether to set up a regulatory asset or a regulatory liability. It's a result of a legally enforceable agreement between the rate regulator and the regulated entity. If it were to go beyond that, that would be beyond the scope of U.S. GAAP. It'd be a violation of U.S. GAAP. So this is ring-fenced very, very tightly around the characteristics of the defined rate regulation in the DP of the IASB. And I think if I were remember, I didn't make these decisions. I'm just telling you what I think were the basis. All right.
Too young, Tom. Yeah.
I'm convinced that with the proper scope, and I think some of the questions that people are asking here are very appropriate as to whether the scope is going to be limited enough where there really is a legal obligation, legal right or obligation in those settings. In those settings, I grew comfortable enough without having to vote and really deliberate on this that there could be assets and there are assets and liabilities consistent with the conceptual framework in a very narrow set. I don't see how you could ever describe most forms of insurance as an essential good, even though the rates are regulated for insurance enterprises. That would say if you lose money on the insurance this period that you're going to make it up in some other future period, that's guaranteed. That's not the sort of nature of the thing. So it's very ring-fenced into some very, very unique circumstances that in that narrow space, perhaps I'm comfortable with assets or liabilities, but not otherwise. I don't have evidence that I can give you. I think I recall vaguely some sort of research study, but I don't remember it. I probably read it 30 years ago or so on that. But I think Francois has given us the best information about how, at least current information, about how users would think about this particular set of information in a very isolated and ring-fenced circumstance, and they find value in it. I think I'd find value in the user if I know that a cost I incurred that was unexpected this period I couldn't charge more revenue to cover it, but for sure I have an agreement that I'm going to be able to cover it in the future. Would that be an expense of this period, or would it be a cost that I'm going to recover so it's got future benefit and asset that I'll expense when I get the revenue in the future? That seems to make some sense to me in very narrow circumstances.
Clemens?
The Japanese voice of concern is not alone in our region. I think the concern actually about this regulatory assets and liabilities, whether there's enough facts to back it up that it should be treated as a different class on its own, rather than look at the conceptual framework recognition. And a couple of comments are made by members which might be relevant to it as well. One of the members actually mentioned about the disclosure aspect that for the rate regulation terms, sometimes because of the country specific regulation, it might not be allowed to be disclosed to the market. So that is also something that we need to consider when we look at the disclosure aspect. And also the within our region, there's a lot of emerging economies, and the government itself, whether from that angle, whether it is whether it is a certainty that the future government will allow, you know, the recovery of the course, you know, the acceleration, the deferral course, and it's about, you know, sort of matching principle of matching the right course and revenue to, you know, accordingly, and whether the government situation will allow that deferral or will make that deferral or acceleration sensible or not. You know, this is also something that that we need to consider. But by and large, I think there's a general support for ISB to sort of carry on with this DP and look further into this area.
Yes, I just wanted to mention what we heard in our meeting with the National Standard Setters last week. The point that was made, I mean, in the form of a question mode, but whether really a complete separate standard is needed or whether it should be derived, in fact, from the revenue recognition standard. And in fact, listening to the concerns, I mean, and the questioning of Jan earlier on, I was thinking in the revenue recognition standard, you have everything to stop recognizing revenue if you start identifying that the revenue requirement would no longer be compatible with what people can or would accept to pay. So
we got about 20 companies in Brazil that are not allowed to recognize regulatory assets under current IFRS, and almost without exception, all of them prepare parallel financial statements, and they present to investors based on those parallel financial statements, which is a shame for me in terms of IFRS, because they use a it's not empirical research, but I believe it's strong argument favorite.
Yes, I just want to add a point that from my point of view, for the information relevant to rate regulated activities, actually, yes, very useful for to users and other stakeholders. So we would fully agree that the point we would like to raise is that we prefer, as Karen just now raised, that we prefer disclosure approach in the notes, not on the balance sheet, not on the face of the financial statement.
Okay. Brings us to the end of this discussion.
Jean? I think so. Thank you very much indeed for your input, and thanks especially to Tom for fielding the majority of the questions that came up there, and also to Francoise for giving us so many very early insights into the preliminary views, and particularly the user needs, which is a key driver, I think, in this project. And Francoise did just briefly mention there is an event in Europe on the 18th of December in Brussels, which is mainly focused at users of financial statements, but is an open invitation to others as well. If anybody is interested, there's details on the EFRAG website as to how to register for that event. There are other outreach events going on, and obviously if anybody else would like to discuss the issue in more depth, then just please do let me know, and if you've got any remaining questions we can deal with offline, then I'll be happy to do that. But thank you very much for both emission trading and rate regulation sessions. Very helpful.